This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, another view on restoration efforts in the Great Lakes. But first, the Labor Day weekend means that the general election campaign will begin for its final months. Here to offer some analysis of where the political climate in Michigan stands as the summer winds down are two Western Michigan University political science professors. Peter Wheelhauer, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And John Clark.
Good morning.
Let's begin with kind of the general question. As we sit here and talk in late August, election's still about 10 weeks away. Where does the landscape stand? Does it look like a wave election, perhaps for the Republican Party, Peter?
Well, I think that nationally, it looks like there's a good opportunity that the Republicans have for perhaps picking up the Senate. Most people seem to agree that they'll probably hold the House, but this question of the open Senate seats and toss-up Senate seats does seem to be looking very promising for the Republicans. Certainly as promising or better than prospects looked in 2010 and 2012.
John, there's, of course, an open Senate seat in Michigan. Is this one of those that the Republicans could pick up, although polls right now show that Gary Peters does have something of a lead?
It certainly is, and it's a seat that folks not just in Michigan but nationally are looking at as a possible Republican pickup, and on the Democratic side, a seat that needs to be defended. And there are a number of other seats that are reasonably close in other places in the country. And then there are many that simply aren't expected to be very close at all. So it's those few seats that are expected to be close or that might be close where a lot of the attention is being focused.
As we move down the ballot, there's a state Senate race, which will be Kalamazoo County. It's an open seat because basically of redistricting. Tanya Shoemaker represented Kalamazoo County, but the way the district was drawn, Van Buren County and Allegan and part of Kent are a new district, and she lives in Van Buren County, decided to stay there instead of moving. So we have two state representatives, Margaret O'Brien, the Republican, Sean McCann, the Democrat, both foregoing one more term in the House, or a potential one more term in the House to run for state Senate. Both pretty well-known people in this area, and a state Senate seat which was not very close in 2010. But we had an interesting situation where the candidate on the Democratic side passed away, a very close race in 2006. Based on the way this county has gone politically, is this a race that we could be watching well into the night on election night?
Potentially so, although the clerks of the various electoral divisions do a pretty good job of getting their returns in these days. But I do expect that this will be a very close race, in part because the county is very competitive. The city of Kalamazoo leans more toward the Democrats. The rest of the county leans more toward the Republicans. But on balance, it's almost a 50-50 split if you average across lots of different elections. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some candidates who have won overwhelmingly, some Republican candidates and some Democrats recently. But I think that the county as a whole is highly competitive, and this is one of the few state Senate seats that's viewed that way. Because the district is the county itself, it's picked up a little bit of a slight bit of a Democratic lean since redistricting with the couple of townships that were outside the county that are now part of a different district. But there simply aren't very many close Senate districts, and this is one of the very few that is, with an open seat, which generally brings in more money, and with two highly qualified, well-respected candidates that most people know at least a little bit about.
Yeah, and I would reiterate the importance of that. The fact that you have two candidates who have run several races in for various positions over the last several years, that gives them a base of name recognition that certainly works to both candidates' advantage and doesn't really give either candidate an overwhelming advantage as we enter into the election season.
That's right.
John, you mentioned that it's one of the few races at the state Senate level considered competitive. I mean, could we really say it's one of the few races for the state legislature and maybe even throw Congress in there that's considered competitive just because of the way districts have been drawn now?
I think absolutely that's the case. And, of course, the redistricting process is a highly political process. And so, you know, both sides want to draw the district lines to their advantage. It just so happens here in Michigan, Republicans have had that opportunity in the last couple of redistricting cycles. But because the county's not split, which certainly could have happened, it is one of the very few that on paper looks to be competitive, regardless of who the candidates might be.
Peter, should we be concerned that we have a lot of competition at the primary level in August when not as many people turn out to vote than we do in November? We see this in a lot of districts, that, as they say, the election's really at the primary level.
Well, there are so many races around the state and around the country where the real competition is in the primary that whichever candidate wins the primary is almost a fait accompli that they will be elected in the fall. So I think, actually, that having a pretty competitive race is a good thing. I really enjoy listening to, I'm maybe one of the few people that really enjoy listening to the give and take of ads and debates and charge and countercharge in the campaigning process. I think that does a lot for informing the electorate, helps us to make better decisions. But the problem with those occurring at the primary level is that what that means is that you're really only speaking to half of the electorate. And so you have half of the electorate who's paying attention. They get fairly well informed about their candidate. The other half of the electorate voting for the other party that's almost certain to lose gets a lot less useful information when it comes to the final decision in terms of for whom they should vote in the fall.
There's a well-known political scientist who famously wrote, I don't know, a number of years ago, that democracy takes place between parties, not within parties. And I think that what we've seen with the way that district lines have been drawn, not just here in Michigan, but across the country, is that there is more democracy, and I'm using finger quotes that you can't see on the radio, that's taking place at the primary stage. So it's essentially within parties rather than at the general election stage between parties, which means that general election voters don't have that same kind of choice necessarily.
That is the case. I would also say, though, that it's not so much a matter of democracy in our system, as the system was not designed to be fundamentally democratic. The system was designed to represent geographies and the people who live in geographies, and that's why we have a representative democracy rather than more of a pure democracy or proportional representation system. It's designed to be that way, and it's almost inevitable that when you have a redistricting reapportionment process that you're going to end up with some districts that are highly competitive and most districts that are not going to be highly competitive, because people with like minds, like employment opportunities, like educational and social status, they tend to live near each other.
Speaking of politics happening within parties, or democracy happening within parties, I guess, is the term that we were using. This past weekend were the state conventions for both the Republican and Democratic parties. There was a challenge to the sitting lieutenant governor at the Republican primary. Wes Nakagiri came up well short. Callie got somewhere between 65% and 70% of the vote of the delegates. But on the Gong Renews site, Zach Gorchow blogged that the Republicans had averted disaster here, that if a sitting lieutenant governor had been displaced at a state convention, it would have seriously damaged not just Governor Rick Snyder's reelection efforts, but the Republicans on down the ticket. Peter, would you agree that would have been a very damaging blow to the Republicans?
I think it would have been a damaging blow to the credibility that the Snyder campaign is trying to build for itself, for its own record, its ability to function with the legislature and cooperate with the legislature. If the governor's key guy is defeated, that does portend poorly for him. And I think that would be a real challenge for them.
And, if we go back 4 years, Callie was added to the ticket in part to balance out the moderation of Snyder. So here's a conservative and somebody who came from the legislature, so he had experience in the legislative process. But he was sort of picked specifically to shore up a weakness. And then if he gets undermined as not being conservative enough, then that certainly would provide some fodder for Democrats in the general election campaign.
And this is one area where I think that the Republican Party establishment has learned a lot of lessons from the last couple of election cycles nationwide. What we saw nationwide, and in this particular case, is that challenges from the right to establishment Republican candidates largely failed. And so you have the establishment that has won nearly all of these races. That means that the establishment learned its lessons. They learned how to effectively allocate their resources to diffuse these kinds of situations, these kinds of challenges to their preferred candidates.
All right.
I want to go back, though, to John's point about Brian Kelly being put on the ticket back in 2010 to sort of balance out Rick Snyder being the more moderate candidate. Does this show that some of the angst that's out there is maybe not so much driven by ideology, but it's the fact that you're now part of the establishment, you're part of the administration when you're Brian Kelly, and your voting record is maybe not as important. Of course, he hasn't been casting votes for 4 years, not very often anyway, just the one tie-breaking vote, I believe, is lieutenant governor. Otherwise, he's running more or less as a representative of the Snyder administration. Does that maybe show some of what's out there in terms of maybe some anti-establishment feelings?
I think that's exactly what it is. And frankly, voters have short memories. I think that now he's very much considered a part of the administration, and so Governor Snyder's record is his record. Michigan has an interesting system when it comes to nominating candidates because we have this hybrid between the use of the primary and the use of the party convention. And so many times what we see is the convention sort of strategically try and place people in positions to balance the ticket. But at the same time, if there is a rogue convention, and sometimes that happens, and it hasn't happened a lot here in Michigan, certainly, but it happens other places, then it's entirely possible that that kind of strategy gets tossed out the window.
It does. And what's interesting about the conventions, which I really like a system that uses a convention, is I think that it's helpful for the parties because on the one hand, it helps to identify and give credibility to insurgencies within the party, but it also acts as kind of a safety valve that those insurgencies get an opportunity to have their voice, to wage a war, to express themselves, and then they kind of blow off all that steam against the party, and then it's easier for them to consolidate as a group rather than trying to consolidate when they're all just kind of sitting back in their living rooms griping about the primary results.
And the convention system, because of the way that delegates are selected, gives people an opportunity to become assimilated into the party itself. And so that energy can be then captured by, you know, the establishment, if you will, in a way that allows folks to have a voice and to focus their energy. My graduate mentor, John Kessel, used to say that the party is the residue of its past campaigns. And the delegate system, the convention delegate system, gives folks who become involved in campaigns the opportunity to have a voice in the party moving forward.
But it is an interesting hybrid system we have in Michigan because the governor and U.S. Senate, those are decided by the voters in the primary. And then as you move down the ballot, other things like attorney general, Kalamazoo resident Mark Totten is going to be the Democratic nominee. Those are decided by the party. And the Democrats have always had a balancing act here because they want a balanced ticket. They want it balanced for race and gender, geography, those sort of things. Some people have looked at this ticket and said, well, it's awfully male-dominated. There's one minority. Is that potentially a problem for Democrats if they're trying to get voters to the polls? Because one of the big worries that Democrats have is that their voters will not turn out in November.
Well, I think that the best analogy to the way that it's done in Michigan with this hybrid system is the way that vice presidential candidates are selected. And, you know, we traditionally think of vice presidential candidates as being important to balance the ticket. So, you know, John Kennedy picks Lyndon Johnson because Johnson is a Southerner and, you know, represents a different wing of the party in some ways and you know, lots of other examples. When Bill Clinton first ran in 1992, he selected Al Gore. And Jesse Jackson sort of famously said that an eagle can't fly with two right wings, suggesting that they both came from the same wing of the party, the moderate to conservative wing of the party, and as a result that liberals weren't going to be represented. But that was the message that the Clinton campaign wanted to send, was that they were not captive to the left wing of the party, that they were a much more moderate ticket, and it sort of worked. And so, you know,
also maybe worked because they were both from the South, and also they were both relatively young at the time in their mid-40s, so it represented sort of a new way of thinking for the Democrats.
That's
party.
Right, and that's how they tried to frame the campaign, and you know, it worked. Wouldn't necessarily have worked every year, but it certainly worked in that year. And you know, we've seen that kind of thing happen from time to time. For the Democrats in this cycle, even before the convention, there were concerns being expressed that the ticket might not turn out to be as balanced as some people would like, which sort of means, you know, a candidate representing me as a part of the party isn't necessarily going to be there. And I think that is potentially a problem if, particularly at the top of the ticket, the candidates, you know, a couple of white guys, are not seen as being able to connect with the various constituencies of the Democratic Party, which could affect turnout.
It is a female lieutenant governor candidate.
I'm sorry, I was thinking Mark Schauer and Gary Peters.
Gary Peters, right.
The the governor's gubernatorial candidate and the United States Senate candidate.
Well, the thing is that the Democrats have these kinds of conversations, and they're almost obsessed with this kind of conversation. And the Republicans don't need to do this hand-wringing. They don't. Then the fact of the matter is that they're able to consolidate much more easily. I think my read is that they tend to be much more pragmatic and strategic and saying, can we get somebody who will help us win, as opposed to making sure that everybody has an equal or proportional voice or some kind of proportional representation of their demographic. The Republicans just don't think that way. And so I think that that gives them kind of an energy advantage, if not a political advantage.
In part because there's not a lot of diversity to be reflected on the Republican side, at least not in a lot of places. And this is a case where the convention helps the establishment to have that kind of pragmatic vision. And in other states where, in high-profile races at the top of the ticket, insurgent candidates have upset the establishment candidate, we've seen some of those insurgent candidates go by the wayside. And one of the reasons that the Democrats still control the United States Senate is because Republicans have nominated by primaries some Senate candidates that simply couldn't withstand the pressures of a general election campaign, and Democratic candidates came from behind and captured Senate seats. Because of the system in Michigan, we're less likely to see that because of the fact that the ticket can be balanced in some way, and politicians, party officials can behave strategically at the convention.
And I think you see here not just the learning on the part of the establishment Republicans, in terms of responding to these insurgencies, but you also see the insurgency itself learning from its past mistakes and saying, we have to nominate better candidates. Just the sheer fact that now this is going to be their third election cycle means that you have people in the Tea Party movement who have more political experience, more practice at what it takes to actually win. And so that enables them to nominate candidates who are just going to be less goofy than previous candidates in the early years of the movement.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Let me go back to one thing, Peter, that you mentioned about the Republicans not necessarily working to balance their ticket. One of the things that people say going forward is if the Republican Party doesn't bring in some different types of voters, especially different racial and ethnic groups, they're going to face some real problems in national elections. That may not be a real concern right now for Michigan's Republican Party in 2014, but looking ahead to 2016 and beyond, that it could be a problem for Republicans. Do they have to start thinking that way, perhaps at the state level, at conventions and those sort of things, to perhaps create a pool of candidates who can move up?
I think it's a strategic question. My sense is that the Republicans focus more on making sure that there is some ideological balance in terms of the ideas. So they do want to balance the liberal, the conservative, and the moderate wings of the party. So they do make those kinds of strategic considerations. I just think that Republicans are much less likely, as individuals and collectively, to conceive of the world as demographically determined. So they're much less likely to be concerned about race and gender in terms of the representation of the ticket than the Democrats are, for whom this is clearly a part of their campaign strategy and the party building strategy that's been a component of it since the days of Lyndon Johnson. So Republicans just think about these things differently. Democrats are much more concerned about them, and so that provides a strength of the Democrats that in fact the demographics now of the nation seem to be working in their advantage over the long haul. And the Republicans do seem to be convinced that it's the battle of ideas that matter, and that the ideology is what is really the communication and the strategic advantage that they hold. And I think that whether that coincides well with the structure of the elections and the competitiveness of the races, I think that's what comes out over the course of history.
I think Pete's exactly right about the Democratic obsession with a coalition of different groups. I think it goes back not just to Lyndon Johnson, but really to Martin Van Buren and the foundation of the Democratic Party as we think of it today. But I think on the Republican side, there is a concern, not so much with race, certainly, but with gender. And I think that the fact that Terry Lynn Land is going to be the nominee for the United States Senate means that they don't have to worry in the convention about finding a female candidate to run for something else. If they have one that's a good candidate, then that's great. If they didn't have one at the top of the ticket, running for United States Senate, then I think there would have been some folks who strategically said, look, we can't look like, if we want to say that the Democrats are dominated by white men, we can't be that either. And so we certainly have seen in previous election cycles attention paid to female candidates for Secretary
Lieutenant
of State,
Governor.
Lieutenant Governor, State Supreme Court, somewhere on the ticket. And I think that that's less an obsession than it is a strategic calculation for the Republicans.
I agree.
And I think for the Democrats, that really is part of the party's makeup, part of the way that they think about how the party should operate, but also how government should operate.
Yeah, I would say that is correct, that for Republicans, it's a little bit of a strategic element or an afterthought to how do we make sure that we're come across in a politically attractive way, whereas for the Democrats, it's much more infused into the party's strategic DNA and the way that they think and view the political process.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Let's try to do this again in the fall.
Absolutely.
Good idea.
Peter Wielhauer and John Clark are both professors of political science at Western Michigan University. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Earlier this month, we heard from commentator Gary Wilson. He had written an essay for Great Lakes Echo, which lamented the slow pace of restoration in the Great Lakes and called for greater focus. That essay drew a rebuttal from Todd Ames, who is campaign director for the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition. He wrote his own essay for Great Lakes Echo, arguing that restoration has produced results throughout the Great Lakes. Todd Ames, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Let me say up front that Gary Wilson's been interviewed by us a few times on a few different subjects, but go ahead and tell us what he got wrong.
Well, you know, he pointed out a number of challenges that remain in the Great Lakes. I certainly don't disagree with the fact that we have many things left to do to restore the Great Lakes fully to the jewels that we all want them to be. But the suggestion that somehow what has happened, particularly in the last few years, has not been just a tremendous, significant step forward, just from my estimation, could not be further from the truth. We've had a tremendous, very focused effort that is the result of a lot of visionary work on behalf of folks from across the Great Lakes region that produced this blueprint for action for the lakes. And lo and behold, in 2010, the federal government actually came through with meaningful funding in a restoration initiative fund that has really produced some wonderful results all across the Great Lakes. So we're very encouraged about where we are and what needs to be done going forward, but we certainly don't in any way want to minimize that we are, it's just a down payment on a lot of good work that needs to happen.
Can you point out some specific accomplishments, things which have been done throughout the Great Lakes region, which, as you say, have made life better for people?
Sure. Again, this initiative known as the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was first funded in 2010. And since then, we've seen $1.6 billion go into a wide array of projects across the Great Lakes Basin that have really been tremendously helpful in terms of cleaning up toxic hotspots, restoring wetlands, reducing runoff from cities and farms, advancing efforts to keep invasive species out of the Great Lakes. Specifically, there's over 2,000 projects across the region. New federal investments have accelerated the cleanup of some of our most polluted harbors, rivers, and lakes. These impairments have been removed, in fact, at a rate that is we've seen more than three times as many impaired water segments restored in the basin since 2010 as we saw in the previous 22 years. We've seen over 115,000 acres of wetlands and other habitat in the Great Lakes restored, improving water quality and creating habitat for fish and wildlife, and nearly 2,000 river miles have been cleared of barriers, resulting in fish swimming into stretches of river where they've been absent for decades.
As you say, there are challenges that do remain. As you see them now, what are the big ones out there? What are some of the other major things that you would like to see done in the Great Lakes?
Well, certainly, we have a long way to go, as I like to say, whether we all need to own up to the fact that we collectively in the Great Lakes Basin spent over 100 years doing great damage to our lakes, and it's going to take a long period of collective effort to fix many of those problems. I would say two of the biggest challenges that we've got right now are the problems of polluted runoff from a variety of sources, whether it is construction site erosion, stormwater issues, or certainly agricultural runoff into our waterways, and then also the continuing impact of aquatic invasive species that are already in our water bodies. Certainly, we want to work to keep out additional invaders like Asian carp, for instance, but if you look at the problems that have occurred recently in Toledo and in Lake Erie, that is a direct result of both excess nutrients like phosphorus, this polluted runoff, combined with the impact of things like quagga and sebum mussels in Lake Erie, which just made an existing problem even worse.
In his essay for Great Lakes Echo, Gary Wilson says that he would argue that these efforts would be better served if Great Lakes restoration was focused on one or two big projects. He cited sewage dumping as an example. Is that possible, and could that be a better strategy?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things where the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is focused on, I would argue, are big projects. One of those areas is, again, these where we've got these legacy contaminants, these contaminated sediments in these harbors around the Great Lakes that for more than 30 years we've known they were there and we've known what we needed to do about them. We just lacked the funding. So I think it's appropriate that, among other places, the Restoration Initiative has focused on cleaning up these toxic hotspots. And if you ask people in places like Sheboygan, Wisconsin, or Muskegon, Muskegon Lake, Waukegan Harbor in Illinois, they would say that this money is very well spent addressing those long-time pollution problems. The other area that Mr. Wilson spoke about, though, the issue of sewer overflows, certainly, and problems associated with wastewater infrastructure, there was a very conscious reason why the Restoration Initiative money was not targeted at that, and that is that there is already an existing funding mechanism, actually a couple of funding mechanisms, to get funds to do that sort of work. It's called the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. So there is an existing mechanism, and that money is being, we actually advocate a lot to retain good, strong amounts of money in those funds each year. But directly as a result of that money, we have seen tremendous improvements in wastewater infrastructure in places like Milwaukee, in Cleveland, Ohio, and in fact in Grand Rapids.
In his piece, Gary Wilson said that dealing with water issues in the Great Lakes region is still in its infancy. When I asked him about that during our interview, he said maybe he should have written preschool or kindergarten. But is it fair to say that restoration is still evolving? And are there still lessons to be learned out there and maybe some different approaches that could still be discovered along the way?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I certainly agree that certain types of restoration, I would say, are in their infancy. One of the things that we made a lot of progress on, thanks to the Clean Water Act passed in 1972, was a lot of progress on so-called end-of-pipe pollution, those pollutants that come, you know, out of the end of a pipe into our waterways that were causing very dramatic problems all across the basin. And, of course, the most dramatic example that everybody knows about is when the Cuyahoga River would regularly catch fire in Ohio. So those days are gone, and we've made a lot of progress on cleaning up those sorts of types of pollutants. But the problems with this polluted runoff and the challenges that we have with that, coupled with the amount of invasive species, we certainly are really in a learning phase in terms of how to deal with that. There is a lot of work being done. The other challenge that we're having now, though, that folks, well, there were certainly some folks who talked about it 20 years ago, but we are really experiencing it now, is the impact of climate change. And in addition to the warming trend problems, we're also having, as all the models predicted, these large episodic rain events or big snowfalls. And that sort of kind of that causes that flash flooding and big stormwater runoff is just something that we did not have anywhere near as much of before the impacts of climate change. So how to grapple with that is also in its infancy, because indeed the problem is something that we've just really experienced in the extreme in the last few years.
Todd Ames, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
Todd Ames is the campaign director for the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.